The Big Story is brought to you by Scotiabank. What does free speech sound like? Depends on who you ask. Toronto's mayoral race isn't really close. Incumbent John Tory has a big lead.
My fundamental responsibilities is to protect the democracy, which binds our society together.
And former city planner Jen Kiesmat is a few dozen points behind.
I'm not bringing forward slogans, I'm bringing forward real solutions that can be implemented.
But then there's a distant third place candidate.
Whites are about to become a minority in our country. They're already a minority in this city. I worry that a lot of the people back here don't want to get rid of white supremacy, but just white presence. And that's a bit more concerning, to be frank.
To be really clear, Faith Goldie is not going to win this election. She's got no chance. But that hasn't stopped her from saying the sort of things that first branded her alt-right, and later, when she was fired from The Rebel for appearing in interviews with a neo-Nazi site as an outright white supremacist. And she's in third place, technically at least, in the mayoral race of one of the world's most diverse cities, so that's news, right? Again, it depends on who you ask, but one thing is clear. As the political spectrum grows more extreme, especially on the right, this is a question every journalist or citizen with a platform is going to have to answer. Do you vanquish hate by trying to shine a light on it, or is it more effective to hope it withers in the darkness? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. David Moskrop is a political scientist, researcher, writer, and columnist. He's also currently studying how political information circulates on the internet. David, am I making a mistake even talking to you about Faith Goldie?
This is the oldest challenge in democratic politics, is knowing what to talk about and what not to talk about. Because every time you talk about something, you're not talking about something else. So there's an opportunity cost to every breath you take and every word you say. And so that's point one. Point two is you don't want to undermine the foundations of democratic politics.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the challenges. So going back to the Greeks, they had a sort of sense of this. Back then, maybe we could bring this back. You could vote, the people could vote to eject someone from society. They could banish them through what they called ostracism, because they recognized that some things were dangerous to the health of the democracy, to the people. So they could vote to ostracize. I could think of a few people I wouldn't mind voting to ostracize.
I think so could so the other side, though.
I mean, every side. And that's the problem, is that it becomes a political tool. But it points to this truth that, not only is there an opportunity cost, there's always sort of certain dangers. And the conceit of liberal politics, small liberal politics, is that, well, we can just talk about everything. It's the marketplace of ideas. In practice, that's very different. In practice, that marketplace of ideas can exclude, it can radicalize, it can do a lot of damage. So the wisdom is knowing what to talk about, when to talk about, and how to talk about it. So with Faith Goldie, just to give a sort of quick answer, I would talk about her a little, but as little as possible, because she's not that serious of a candidate. In terms of her chances, and in terms, I think, of the constituency she represents, but it does have to be acknowledged.
That's the question I struggle with, because I come from that small L liberal school of politics that says we should drag these things out into the light and talk about them. And I know a lot of people feel the same way. And I know a lot of people who are from some marginalized groups who are very much more affected than I am by the ideas that these kind of groups espouse, say, no, that's not the way you do it. You don't argue with somebody that espouses views that are tantamount to viewing some people as not people.
Yeah, so Isaiah Berlin, himself a liberal, years ago had made the argument that freedom for the pikes is death to the minnows. So what some of us think of as freedom and don't think through from another perspective is actually not freedom to other people. And so that's so in a democracy, the question you want to ask yourself is, okay, how do we create a democratic space where people can learn and discuss ideas, figure out what they want and share that with one another and with politicians, in which everyone or most as many people as possible can participate? And when someone comes along who undermines that or threatens that, then we say that, no, you've crossed the boundaries, because what you're doing is undermining the foundation that allows us to have all these other things. That without that foundation, we can't build anything on top of it. And if you're going to come and chip away with it, we're going to say, no, you got to move along. The question is, okay, well, where do you draw that line? And who gets to decide? And that's tricky. But my answer is we sort of get to decide collectively as individuals, and the media gets to decide collectively as effectively as gatekeepers of information, and you just kind of figure it out as you go case by case. So you wouldn't want Richard Spencer, you'd say, no, that's too far. There's no value added there. Move on. Faith Goldie, I'd lump her into that. I'd say it's just not worth digging deeply into what she has to say because it does more harm than good, and the people have a right to conclude that and say, okay, we're going to focus on other people instead.
What about the idea that, I mean, look, Faith Goldie is running third, according to some polls, in Toronto's mayoral race. Now, it's a distant third. But there's no question that a certain subset of the population shares her views. Don't we have a duty to talk about that, to cover the fact that this is a rising tide of xenophobia and racism?
Yeah, I think so. But I also don't think it's a binary, either we cover it or we don't cover it. I think it's, okay, well, how much do we cover it? And if she has, I don't know, 3-4% of the support or 5% of the support, maybe you give her 3-5% of the coverage. One of the risks, though, is that people like that get outsized coverage for whatever reason, because they're controversial, because we think they're a threat, whatever it may be. And so they end up actually getting proportionally more coverage than we think they should. But we draw lines all the time in politics, for instance, with debates. You know, we say, well, geez, we can't have 12 people on the stage. We can have 4, maybe we can have 5. And from a political perspective, in terms of cognition and democratic decision making, if you have too much information, it's worse than having very little information. You're better off with a small, manageable amount than a ton. So we sort of say, okay, well, we've got to limit things. And if the idea is we want to make good political decisions, then we've got to know where to draw the line. And again, I think, a distant third, might represent a constituency that deserves a little bit of attention, but not a ton. And then to add to that, if there are folks out there who don't like it, and it is indeed a marketplace of ideas, some other outlet can come along and cover her. If the Rebel wants to cover her, the Rebel can cover her. If Joe Warmington wants to follow her around town, Joe Warmington can go follow her around town. But I think that most of us should give her no more than, the 3-4% attention that she deserves.
Up next.
You might say, well, someone said something racist, and we've all decided that it's racist, and we know it when we see it. But can you call that person a racist? Well, that's a different level.
You can save like never before with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus Savings Account. And right now, for a limited time, you can earn up to 3% interest until March 10th. You can find all the terms and conditions at scotiabank.com/MP. Is there any way that we can talk about politicians like this without helping them? Like, is me just saying her name a win, or is anybody covering Faith Goldie a win, or is there a way that we can cover them that's responsible and kind of gets at what they really are?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it depends on what that coverage looks like and whether or not it's critical and contextual. I'd say the more critical and contextual and honest it is, the better. That said, a lot of politics is name recognition. A lot of politics is what we're able to, as normal folks, think about off the top of our head. What's available, what we call availability in psychology literature. Every time that you talk about this, you make something more available. You make something a little bit more salient to people. So there probably is no way to do that without putting her or someone like her on the radar. On balance, does it do more harm or good to her campaign? It's going to depend. So who knows? But there's always that risk that you end up helping the cause, so to speak, just by making it more available to people and more salient. That's unavoidable. That's one of the paradoxes of speech. And it's true of even, for instance, lies. A good example is someone lies and that goes around and a lot of people hear about it. That lie gets retracted. Someone apologizes, gets corrected. There's going to be a number of people who continue to believe it no matter what. That's just one of the effects of speech in this age. And I don't think we've fully figured out how to manage that. And frankly, I don't think we ever will.
Well, lies are a good example because there's often a question about what you call them, right? We heard that with Trump a lot in the New York Times and other places where it would be like Trump disputes claim or Trump says this, but it wouldn't actually say lie. And I wanted to ask you specifically about the language that we use when we cover politicians who make racist statements. And is there something in the way of some outlets calling it what it is?
Yeah, so this is, with Trump, you often got the euphemism untruth. And the reason you got that was because it was verifiably, what he said was verifiably untrue, but you couldn't verify that he knew it was untrue. So you could say that he was speaking an untruth, but you couldn't call him a liar because you didn't know what his intention was.
Right.
And the ascribing intention is the tricky bit here. So you might say, well, someone said something racist, and we've all decided that it's racist, and you know we know it when we see it. But can you call that person a racist? Well, that's a different level. And of course, especially in a litigious society where nobody wants to get slammed with defamation, it becomes also a challenge. And we've seen lots of behavior where folks don't like what's being said about them. Stuff you might think of as fair comment, but they'll try to silence you through threatening action.
And that's where racially charged comes from.
Exactly. And this is something we have to work out legally. And of course, it's often the free speech warriors who are the ones doing the threatening suits, right? Well, you know, we're often called slap suits, suits that are designed to stifle speech. But you know, a slap is a strategic lawsuit against public participation. It's trying to get people not to intimidate people or to keep them out of the public space. We haven't figured out what to do with that yet. And I don't think we will. I mean, there's some attempts to knock down slap suits here and there. But as a society, we're at once committed to free speech, but also extremely litigious.
Right.
And we just haven't worked that out yet.
I wanted to use Faith Goldie to kind of get at the larger issue, not to talk about her specifically, but the way that sometimes denying politicians coverage can have the opposite effect. I mean, when they're barred from debates or when people are making a specific point of not including them, that often becomes oxygen the other way.
Yes. And I mean, to some extent, you saw that with Trump. At least it fed into the sort of outsider narrative of, well, the elites want to keep us down and we need to stand up and we need to show them who's boss. And he sort of played the Andrew Jackson 2.0 thing and played it well. And that's always a risk, too. And one of the challenges here is that, you know, we can't predict ahead of time what's going to be, you know, stifling that minimizes the damaging effects of someone's campaign. That might be a campaign of division, might be a campaign of whatever, maybe racially charged campaign or whatever you may say. We can never tell ahead of time what's going to amplify that and what's going to stifle it. So when you can, you should come up with a rule and you should try to apply that rule. So, you know, you don't get in the debate unless you're polling at 10%, for instance. That's a good rule. Or, you know, if you're not polling above 10%, then we're not going to cover you as a major candidate or something like that, rather than saying ahead of time, well, we just don't like what you have to say, and therefore we're not going to cover it. Because then you get to say, well, Jesus, the elites are keeping me out. That said, they're going to try to make that point either way.
Yeah.
But at least a consistent process, because it's good for them politically, and, you know, do you blame them? But at least a consistent set of rules, you know, allows you to have the integrity of saying, well, look, there are rules, we follow the rules, and what do you want from us? It's a world of scarce resources and time and attention or whatever it may be. But, you know, really quickly on this, the anti-elite sentiment, that populist anger and resentment, that's much, much bigger than Faith Goldie's campaign or Donald Trump's campaign. That's got roots in, you know, economic inequality. It has roots in changing ideas about what's acceptable in society, about the role of racialized folks in society. And there's a constituency that just isn't able to adjust to that. And so we're going to be having this fight for a long time. These are going to be very significant growing pains for the foreseeable future, for sure.
How do you, or can you even, separate the xenophobia and racism from populism? Is there a way to make that movement work without, I guess, punching down?
I mean, I think so. There is a conception of populism that could be inclusive. I mean, it just depends on what you mean by the people. You know, it happens to be the case that what we talk about as populist, although some political theorists and thinkers would say that's not really populist, that's mobocracy. I think it happens to be the case that these folks who are using the populist lens are often about something else.
Yeah.
And I'll let people fill in for themselves what that something else may be. But they're really not about, if you were to really sit down with them and have a deep dive and, you know, try to get at what they're about and what they want and where it comes from, you'll find very quickly that maybe it's not about populism. Maybe it's about something else, or it's motivated by something else. But its expression ends up being about this group of disaffected folks who feel like the elites are bullying them and have left them out. So I'm inherently distrustful of that because of the sorts of people who are leading. I trust the people. I distrust the rabble rousers who want to lead them because they're usually the ones who are causing the trouble.
If you were going to go in and talk to a major nonpartisan newsroom that was struggling with how to cover a candidate saying things like Faith Goldie has said or like Donald Trump has said in the past, what would be at the top of your list for ways they should approach them?
I mean, rule for me, the first thing would be, okay, well, what's the rule? We need a working rule for when something is newsworthy and we're going to cover it and when it's not and we won't. And then rule two would be make sure that you're not giving outsized attention to this person because you're chasing the controversy. I mean, it's so easy to fall into that trap of chasing the controversy because, well, you know, maybe it's in the public interest. Maybe people are interested in it, but people are interested in lots of stuff, and lots of stuff is in the public interest. So make sure you're not giving more oxygen than is necessary. It's the same thing with Twitter users. You know, I mean, I'm as guilty of this as anyone, but you get outraged by something, and so you talk about it. Maybe you quote tweet it. Maybe you try to get in a fight with a troll. You know, you just don't feed the trolls. I mean, that and maybe that's the ultimate rule. Is knowing when something is just plainly a trolling behavior and, you know, you exercising the restraint of not feeding the trolls, which is extremely valuable. But again, you know, there's going to be a little flexibility on case-by-case basis because things are fluid. But, you know, the media's job is to talk about things that are in the public interest, but they also have to keep in mind that there's an opportunity cost. So be very, very careful what you consider not just in the public interest, but what you're leaving out when you're talking about something else.
So you got a book coming out called Too Dumb for Democracy. How much does the discussion we're currently having today about who gets press coverage play into that?
Oh, quite a bit. And I talk about this all the time. More generally, I have a section in the book that basically says, look, if you were going to design an environment in which you wanted people to make good political decisions, you would do the opposite of what we've done. You know, you'd want it to be slow. You'd want information to be limited. You would want there to be time to think and politicians who'd be encouraging deliberation. And you wouldn't just use partisanship and anger as a cue. We've done all the opposite of that. We're just begging to make bad political decisions. And, you know, we've made them in the past and we'll make them in the future, too. So this is right in line with the thing I've been spending the last couple of my years of my life thinking about.
Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
David Moskrop, writer, researcher, columnist, political scientist. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotiabank. You can earn up to 3% interest until March 10th with the Scotiabank Momentum Plus savings account. Conditions do apply. For more from us, visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. Check out our other episodes there and contact us with your own story ideas. Find us on social media, at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, and Instagram. And of course, wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe, rate, review, listen again, tell a friend. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.